Well, hello, everybody. I'm Jefferson Jones, the Youth and University Program Manager at Be the Bridge. And I have one of my co-workers, one of my friends, one of my sisters in the Lord, Elizabeth Behrens, and she is coming to help us have a conversation. She is one of the, if not the key educator and content developer at Be the Bridge. And it has been a delight to listen to her, learn from her, and just actually, you know, do some training alongside her when we were out in
Kansas,
oh,
rural
yeah.
Kansas. Me and Jefferson
Absolutely.
taking it on. It was fun. That was a lot
and
of
so,
fun.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That food was good. Anyway, and so we're here to talk about this question. Has America ever been a racist country? And we're going to navigate this conversation, you know, as bridge builders, as those who are racial reconcilers, who look to do things in a way that honor God, that show the character of God, and really show the heart of God. That's what Be the Bridge is all about. How do we navigate this in this political society that we live in, a racialized society, and so many other things? And so we want to get into that. With that being said, Elizabeth, you know, I was talking with you recently about a clip from one of the politicians who's running. And for me, it isn't so much about a person. It is about the content of what's being said, the ideology, the culture of what's being said, this continual desire to suppress or get rid of cognitive dissonance as we deal with these hard topics. So I'm going to pause there and just allow you to kind of dig into this a little bit. I will say this, the phrase was said, America has never been a racist country. We've already posed the question. How do you, what's going through your mind when you hear that?
Ooh, lots of things. Lots of things. One of the first things that comes to mind is that usually the term racist gets thrown around a lot of times with good reason, but also I find it's a term that we all use, but I feel like oftentimes the disagreements are happening because we have different dictionaries. So like, what do you mean America has never been a racist country? Like, how are you, in what way are you defining racism in order for that to be true? Because I'm sure you could give racism a definition where that statement would be true, right? You could say every person, if in order for America to be a racist country, every person in America had to be actively racist all of the time. Okay, then sure. Maybe you could say, like, there's always been people here who have not been engaged in active overt racism. Absolutely true. Does that mean we're not a racist country? That's where that definition piece comes in. Because to me, I'm going to say that definition feels intentional. If the definition requires that standard to be met, to be given the label racist, then I wonder why you would place the bar so low for a country you say you love and want to lead. That would be concerning to me. And I think it's hard because to think of, like, the nation is such, like, a big complex concept. Like, it's both a nation state, a political entity. It's also a people group. It's also a way, there's a sense of pride in country. Like, so it's hard to have the conversation around that. So I actually like to kind of shrink it down and say, it might be hard to say, like, is a whole country racist and how do you define that? Let's shrink it way down and say, like, let's say a business. Let's say if someone said, like, this business, that this entity that is working and making money and doing a thing, is it a racist business? Has it ever been a racist business? Okay, how would we even go about trying to figure that out? I would say, what are the parameters for that? Would it matter? Are we defining that based on, are all of the employees there racist? Is the leadership of the business racist? Are the policies of the business racist? Are their practice, are their practices racist? Are there some departments within a company that are racist? And if those departments are allowed to continue to engage in that way in a racist fashion, and the non-racist factions don't seem to care or interject or do anything about that, does that make the whole business racist? That's where that definition piece comes in, right? Because I think the first thing I would do if I was trying to have a conversation with this politician who said this is I would say, like, how are you defining racist? And why does it feel important to you to say that? Because even if we get to a shared definition, we might still disagree. She might still hold her own opinions on that. She gave away who we're talking about. But I would want to hear, like, why that is important. And I think that's important to consider, because first we have to be working for the same definition. And then we have to figure out, what kind of conflict is this? Like, what kind of disagreement are we having about, is America racist or not? This kind of disagreement is always the work of narratives. Like, what narrative are we doing? And so there's a framing narrative there. There's a framing narrative that says, I'm going to make this statement because it says something about me and it says something about this country. And I want to frame myself and this country in a certain way. Like, framing narratives do a lot of work. The stories that we tell ourselves to accomplish a sense of identity. And so she's saying that, not just because certain data points prove or disprove it, but because that says something about who she is, how she wants America to be seen. So I would want to talk about with her, like, why is that important? Why is that framing important? Because once we have a shared definition and an understanding of framing, then I feel like we actually have a way forward that isn't just slinging facts back and forth, which is usually how these disagreements go, of like, well, what about voting laws? Well, what about the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation? Well, what about, like, we could go back and forth with things from history. But again, if we're going back and forth without first coming up with a shared definition of, here's what it would mean for America to be racist, we would have to meet X, Y, Z, like all the people or all the policies or some of the policies or any of the policies, right? Like, once we have that definition and then we figure out why it's important to frame it a certain way to the person you're talking to, then we can actually have a bigger conversation, I think, that is much less the way most political debates go and more fits into that bridge building model of how do I hear where you're coming from? How do I extend an olive branch, even when that's hard sometimes? But an olive branch, not that says what you're saying is I agree with, but an olive branch of saying, I want to figure out why you're saying it and what you're saying means to you, so that we can figure out a way to have a bigger, better story, a bigger, better conversation about it.
Yeah, that's really good. You made me think about, you said policies. And as you said policies, I begin to think about documents. And I begin to think about founding documents and key documents that have played the role of shaping the nation. Mm-hmm. In that, I say now the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. All men are created equal. Mm-hmm. And we know for us, we have to look at things with a biblical mindset, mm-hmm. A God mindset. And we know Genesis 1, 26, 27, God created man in his image. And in that laid the foundation of the framework for all men to truly be equal. Mm-hmm. And so when this was written in this document, were they talking about all men, all people groups, mm-hmm. men and women, different ethnic groups, different ethnic populations? Were they all included when that was penned?
Yeah, and I think it's important because I think even probably the next phrase, like, and bound by their creator. And when I hear the see and hear the word creator in there, I think, okay, we got to tap into the theology of the time as well, right? Like, what did they believe? Okay, this people group that's all equal it by their creator. So like they all have the same creator, right? Well, we can look back at the time and see what were even the beliefs around Genesis at that time. Well, there were a few of them. One was a polygenesis theory where there was a large contingent who thought that actually the creation narrative happened multiple times for each different racial group, were completely separate entities. Then you have to consider these other entities as they're writing. Who is this about? We know who they were writing about, right? They wrote that right into the rest of the laws. Or there was this degeneration theory of like, oh, God created white people and then all these other groups are degenerated from that. So they wouldn't be included in this idea of all men. That is a degenerated form of human according to the theology of some of the people writing that document. So we can say like, well, how could we be a racist country if we said all men are created equal? And say, who did they think was included in that? That matters, because the phrase on its own, decontextualized, sure, sounds great. Doesn't sound racist at all. But when you put it in context, you can go, oh, that meant something different to them than it means to us when we read it today. And that's important. That's important in, because to me, when I'm considering like, are we a racist country? I would say would need to be a holistic consideration. I don't think it's necessarily about every individual or every instance or event that happened in America. Just like there can be, you know, we can look at other isms and things. Like there can be deep classism within a country, even if that country sometimes makes really good laws that are helpful for the poor. Mm-hmm. Right? Still can be a classist nation. It can be a deeply sexist nation, even if it passes some equal rights for women, because we can also look at like, but what's the bigger, broader experience? What are the things that are allowed to continue in that space that are oppressive to women? It's gonna be the same with racism. Like, sure, we can have the Emancipation Proclamation, but why did we need an Emancipation Proclamation? Because we had race-based slavery. Okay, so even if we said, okay, the Emancipation Proclamation, a racist country doesn't do that. Okay, so let's go 5-10 years before that. Are we a racist country at that point? Like, what's your event to decontextualize the fact that we have 4 million enslaved Black people because of their race? So, you know, and if we're going to say we've never been a racist country, you would have to go all the way back to the beginning, right? If we're going to say never, and like the very first documents that were written for America said, this is a white man's country. They outright said it.
I'm glad you said that. I have a quote I want to share.
Yeah. I'm like, you can keep trying to find events in history, but if you're saying never, that means never. If you think a civil war fought, it rids the country of being racist, okay, fine, believe that. But I'm going to go a bit before that and say, you had to be white to be a citizen. That's racist, right? Like, that is structural racism, and political, like, at its core, that's part of our history. We didn't, if we had to fight a civil war for a reason,
states' rights.
That means we had something that needed fixed. It was our racist origins. So, yeah. So that never piece, I think there's a lot more debate about, are we now? Are we currently a racist nation? And I'm like, that's a conversation I'm happy to engage in. But the idea of never, to me, doesn't make any sense when it's codified into our earliest laws and statutes and ideologies of our leaders. You know, were there some anti-racist people in the earliest days of America? I'm sure there were. I mean, there were Native Americans living here who weren't on board with white supremacy. Does that make us no longer racist because there are some people here who weren't? I don't think it does, but that is a definitional debate we could have before having the larger conversation about this.
Yeah. And then with that, people being willing to say, okay, I'll have that conversation. And then do you have the, you know, the advantage to be able to decide whether you want to have the conversation or not? You made me think about how the language of white men during that time really impacted the outcome, in society and the outcome for different people groups. And so we know 1776, but then if we fast forward to 1860, April 12th to be exact, a Mississippi Senator Jefferson Davis on the floor of the U.S. Senate said, this government was not founded by Negroes, nor for Negroes, but by white men for white men. Then he went on to say later, the inequality of the white and black races was stamped from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot going on right there in that so little much. Phrase.
So much. And then even right after, just post-Civil War, you know, we had Lincoln is assassinated and Johnson takes over. And what does Johnson say on that same floor? He says, this is a white man's country. And by God, as long as I am president, it will stay a white man's country. That's not an exact, that's a slight paraphrase, but literally came out and said, this is a white man's country. At post-Civil War, post-emancipation.
Yeah. So
if the highest lead, if the person in the highest position of leadership outright says we're a racist nation, are we gonna? I mean, you can debate if you have a different definition, I suppose. But like, your definition is doing a lot of work.
That's like if you go overseas to a kingdom, and the king says, from now on, red will always be seen as the color black.
Mm-hmm.
It's what it is.
Mm-hmm. Like that's the leadership position. And I think this really goes back to like, yeah, we can like the data is on the side of saying yes, at minimum America has been a racist nation in the past, like at that's like lowest bar, but like
that's lowest bar,
but it exists apparently exists as something as we discussed. But I really think it goes back to what part of your identity is wrapped up in America not being racist or America never having been racist. And I think that's where I think real bridge building work happens too, because there is a reason one would say that. There is a reason that one would need to feel that that we aren't or never have been. And that is because a piece of our identity is tied to being American for a lot of people. And so if my identity is tied to being an American and I'm willing to say America is a racist country, what am I saying about me? And I think that's where the rubber meets the road.
All right. So now it's going to get a little more complicated,
mm-hmm.
because we have, and we've talked about this. This came up when we were, this is not a secret, when we were in Hayes, because we know that they have leaders who are African,
mm-hmm.
and that immigrants brings in a whole nother layer.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that there are people in America who are immigrants, and they are first, second generation, and their parents may have been born in another country.
Mm-hmm.
They were born here or not in their native country, come to America, and if they are a non-white person and they want to assimilate or be a part of the in crowd, they will almost denounce, dismiss, throw away their ethnic roots in order to be in the in crowd. Mm-hmm. What does that do, not just to that person, but what does that do to the work that has been done before them and to other immigrants and other African-American, other people, other BIPOC in this nation who embrace their identity and really want to see change happen?
I mean, speaking from my lane, I would say that's been the story of white America, right? Like there are lots of people groups that are now considered white that were not always considered white. The first group that really comes to mind that there's a, you know, well-documented history on is like Italians, that Italians in early America were considered people of color. They weren't considered fully white. They weren't fully white. They were white adjacent. And it wasn't until they engaged in white solidarity and an anti-blackness that they got put into the fold of being considered fully white. And that happened post-Civil War, is when Italians first really got to be considered white, and not face the same kinds of discrimination they were facing. But that didn't happen because we suddenly became a better non-racist nation. That happened because of shedding an Italian identity, and saying part of what it is to be an Italian immigrant is in America is to embrace whiteness and to embrace anti-blackness. And I think that there are lots of other immigrant groups that do likewise, that they are following a well-trod path of how do you get to be seen as fully American? Part of being seen as fully American is engaging in white culture, is engaging in the politics of whiteness, is engaging in the whole variety of things that make you be seen as acceptable within white communities. And part of that is anti-blackness still to this day, is a way to be fully seen. And so when I see, particularly when I see children of immigrants, tends to be a group that there is a decent, like you can see some anti-blackness there. Like that is a really hard feature in America, is that anti-blackness is still tied to being seen as acceptable. And so when I see that being engaged in, I say, you're following my people's path. I'd advise against it, obviously. It did not go well. It still doesn't go well. But the way that for there to be, especially in the current political climate, now down to one woman of color up on stage, but she wasn't the only person of color on stage prior, but both engaged in anti-blackness and were as a way to be seen as fit to be on that stage. And that is so is America a racist country? Well, if I have to engage in anti-blackness to be seen as acceptable, that's another definition point for me of what does it mean to be a racist country? Well, I would say if you have to be engaged in anti-blackness in order to make it to the highest ranks within a leading political party, then yeah, that sounds racist to me. That sounds pretty racist.
And I got to change my name.
Yeah.
You know, these layers of things. And this isn't, you know, like I said earlier, I wanted to highlight that this isn't an isolated event. This is a continual cultural event that happens, that has been happening, continues to happen year after year, generation after generation. And I am now being a little vulnerable, bringing it home. Yesterday, my youngest son ended up telling us a story of something that happened to one of his friends in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And now you've seen my youngest. Mm-hmm. He's a little lighter than I am. And then he has another friend who is dark skinned. And this girl who is Filipino called his friend the N-word with a hard ER. And then also, then he waited, kept going. He said, but there's more. She also called my son the N-word with the hard ER. And so as what we're talking about, you know, immigrants, we're talking about non-white people who are what, first, second generation, and their children in middle school are doing this now. My question, okay, where did she get that from? And what in her makes her think that that is okay to say to another person who is also in a category of being non-white? So this thing is, and it's I got to make a school visit.
Yep.
Today. But
we had the same or very similar situation at the end of last year where my son, who is Black, had the N-word with the hard ER written in his yearbook. And it from another student of color. And so I look at there's a piece of me that wants to just go rampage things, right? Like, and there's a piece of me that says, I can have, it's not, compassion's even not the, compassion's not the right word. I can see an ounce of, because I can see where it comes from. I can see where that history of here's how I become acceptable. Here's how I get ahead. Here's how I'm successful in this country. This is the kind of behavior agent. Again, a path laid out by my people, well-worn, well-practiced. I say we need, like, it needs called out on every level. But I see where you would want to say, we're not a racist country, because that's a lot easier than having to deal with kids getting called the N-word at school, right? Like, it, because it, then it becomes, oh yeah, that's happening, but that's not my problem. I can remove that from my picture of America. I can remove that from needing to address it. If I surround myself with, if I surround myself with whiteness and with those willing to engage in whiteness, which is not a skin color, but an ideology.
Okay.
If I only surround myself with those willing to engage in whiteness, I can get I might even be able to get what is a pseudo diverse group of people together, but who are all willing to engage in the system of whiteness, the system of anti-Blackness, a system of historical erasure, of going along with structural racism because because I figured out how to benefit from it or whatnot. You know, like, there is, you can, it that doesn't require white skin to engage in the acts of whiteness.
That's good. I think a lot of people need to understand that. I love, you know, just the basic definition that whiteness is not a person. It's whiteness is not a skin color. It's a system. It's a way of thinking. And people still get bothered by that. And when I say whiteness, people think that I'm talking about them. And when you understand race as a social construct, white isn't even, you can't be white.
Like, no. Well, when the reality is that who white changes every decade in the U.S. census, it's not a thing. It gets
right.
It is a very real entity, but it's not a biological reality, and it's not a fixed. It's a fluid definition, but it's based around who's willing to engage in the ideology of whiteness. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can look at early. It's sort of been about 1912, 1915, somewhere right in there. There's a Supreme Court case that went up. It was Dow v. U.S. and Dow was a Syrian immigrant. And at the time, you had to be Black or white to be a citizen. So even if we think like, oh, well, post-Civil War, well, that's still excluded whole swaths of people because of their race. But I look at the ways that, like, how do we engage in white? Like, how can a person of color engage in whiteness? And I see that in there because there had been certain parts of the country were allowing Syrians to become citizens and considering them white. And other parts of the country were saying, no, Syrians are Asian.
Okay.
So all the way to this guy, Dow, gets turned down for citizenship. So he takes it all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the argument before the Supreme Court, which I think is interesting because we haven't touched on this much, but the way that Christianity in America has been willing to engage in the ideology of whiteness. Just going to unscrew a whole can of worms just right there. The argument that he made was, if you say that I'm not white, and you look at where I am from, then you are saying that Jesus wasn't white. And the Supreme Court said, I guess Syrians get to be considered white because they were unwilling to engage that they would, if they didn't, they would have to say that Jesus was of Asian descent. Because at the time that area would have been considered of Asian descent. And they were unwilling to have an Asian Jesus. So they declared, like, the Supreme Court declared Jesus white.
and who does the Supreme Court represent in terms of countries?
You know, I think it might represent maybe a slightly racist country, little racism in our past.
A little bit. And that Jesus piece. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're a country that your highest courts have to declare your deity to be of a certain racial group so that otherwise you are unwilling to worship them. And what does that say about whether or not you're a racist country?
That's good. Give people something to think about. So with that, with all of what we've already shared, how does the, okay, so you have kids. How old are your kids?
15, 13, 11, and 7.
15, 13, 11, and 7. I have a 14-year-old and I have now 13-year-old. The oldest will be 15 in April. And so when it comes to, you know, I work with youth, I work with university students, college students, they're adults. You know, they're young adults, but they're still in that stage. It's still formative, still brain still being formed. Some of them still growing.
Oh, I remember those years quite well.
Uh-huh. And so, like, for parents who will watch this or see this, and college students, how do we navigate this? Like, how do you approach these topics when it comes to, like, middle and high school kids?
You know, it's a good question. And I think it really, two things. One, it's not at all common for white families to talk about race. When we look at, like, statistically, it doesn't come up around white dinner tables the way it does, which always boggles the minds of my friends of color who are like, this was like a nightly, almost nightly comfort. Like, what? So it, for white families, it means breaking some cultural norms around silence on these issues. Ideally, that starts really young because it's a lot less, it's a lot less uncomfortable for the parents who are like, I'm not used to talking about this. I don't know if I'm saying the right words. It's a lot easier to have those conversations with a preschooler where we're just talking about how cool it is that all these people look different. And, you know, my background is in elementary and middle level education. So within that world, we would say we're scaffolding, like we're building the first scaffold so that you can build this, you know, scaffolds build on each other so you can get higher and higher and higher.
I like to think in terms of TV shows and ratings, like start G rated.
There you go. Yes. Because you're going to have the G rated conversation with the preschooler, right? You're building that first level.
You just gave me an idea. Okay, keep going.
The hard thing is, if it hasn't been a topic of conversation at all, and then suddenly we're trying to have a conversation that requires a six-story scaffold, you can't build a six-story scaffold, right? Like, you can't just, you have to be able to get up to the top of it. And it takes time to get up to the top of it. So it's going to be
takes
really
what?
A conversation.
It takes what? What does it take? It takes time.
Takes time.
Takes time.
Okay. And it takes concerted and it takes effort and intentionality. It's not just going to happen. And so it's going to take having, and maybe you've realized, oh shoot, well, I don't have preschoolers. I have older kids and we haven't really talked about this much. You know, I think at that point you don't try to just talk about the current event. You come at it, especially if those of us all raising teenagers know they're fairly sure. A lot of them are fairly sure they have life figured out. Right. And they do have a lot of amazing insights and understand the world in ways that are different than us, as every generation does. So coming out of like, figure out what they already know, figure out what scaffold, like, hey, maybe I didn't build all the scaffold, but the odds are that they've had conversations at school, they've seen stuff on TikTok, mm-hmm. it is, start with figuring out what they already know or what they already think about race in America and racism in general. And go from there. Open up a conversation about it. Don't feel like you have to come in with a plan and all the answers to all of their questions, but rather like find out what they already know and talk about what kind of learning could happen together. Because like I said, you can't jump up to a sixth floor, but odds are good that your kids already have some sense of ideas about these things.
Yeah.
And likely within that is if they're just absorbing things from the world around them, because I would argue that we live in a country with a lot of racism. They've likely absorbed some of that regardless of their skin tone, whether it's internalizing white supremacy, internalizing racism. You're gonna likely have to talk through some of that as well. So I would say open up the conversation by simply asking them what they think about fill in the blank, whether it is a current event or an idea, or watch a movie together and ask them what they thought about the racial components within it. You know, bring up those conversations so that you can gauge where they're at, and then you can gauge what does that mean for you moving forward. But you can't know how to move forward unless you know what they already are thinking about and know, because kids form some pretty strong opinions. We were all there, you know, we're all there. And these kids have way more access to the rest of the world than any of us did. So, mm-hmm. so they may know a lot more than we think.
Yeah. Okay. There's a quick question, might be a longer answer, but how would you respond to someone who refuses to believe that the U.S. was founded upon racist ideals?
I would say, first is like my own understanding of them is that we talked earlier about framing narratives. Yeah. There's also founding narratives, right? Founding narratives are really important. Origin stories do a lot of work, work that we don't even necessarily see. But origin stories, every nation, every people group, every religion, everybody, we all have an origin story. And that origin story is oftentimes less about giving a historical accounting and more about saying, this is who I am. This is what it means to be me. This is what it means to be us, this people group. So I would say that person is deeply engaged with a founding narrative that allows them to think positively about themselves and their country.
Mm.
So I would first want to know what role that founding narrative is playing in their sense of identity. Like, why are they so married to the idea that we aren't a racist country or never have been a racist country? What work is that origin story doing for them? You know, and so then my response to them would vary greatly depending on their response to that. If they said, you know, oh, well, I just think it's the truth. And I think if it's okay, if truth is really important,
I just think
then like, okay, we're no longer on opposite sides, right? If truth is really important, then like, yes,
that's good.
So now we're no longer adversaries who are debating this. We have common ground. We both care about the truth. Great. Let's pursue truth together. If their response is like, well, I love America and I don't want to see America as a racist country, or I don't want America to be a racist country. Great. We're again now on the same side of the table. We are not adversaries. I too do not want to marry.
Yeah.
Let's figure out where there are, where there might be, even if you, even if I'm, I know, even if I never with them again engage with the idea of making them believe that America as a whole is a racist country, fine, whatever. If you don't want America to be a racist country, we are on the same side. Let's figure out where there are, like where there are vestiges, where there are, you know, where there's racist residue, or where there's, you know, I'm going to watch my language, but I'm like, hey, if we're on the same side, if you don't want America to be racist, I don't want America to be racist. Let's work together to make sure America's not racist. And so I think more than trying to convince them that it was, or is, I'm going to say, where is the bigger story? Because we're having a conflict about data, and data conflicts almost always are not actually about data. Like when we look at the different kinds of conflicts that exist out there, there's a lot, there's, you know, depending on which model you use, but one of them is that there's idea that's like, there's data conflicts, interest conflicts, and values conflicts. So like a data conflict is like, we have different information, so we're in conflict. But like the different information, you, if it's actually just a data conflict, then giving, being given the correct data solves the conflict. There is something else happening here, because we can all read the same history books and the conflict has not been resolved. So this is not a data conflict. So I'm not going to argue data when I can tell that this isn't a data conflict. Like if I've given you information and we are not immediately on the same page,
mm-hmm.
data. This has shifted into interest and values. And those conflicts take a lot more work, and they are not solved by simply by information alone. They're solved by understanding what's the underpinning here? What's causing, like, where is your identity tied? And why do you see this as important? Like, this is, values are like, those are those like deep beliefs. They're part of who I am. So if this idea that we're not a racist country is a part of who you are as a person, then giving you information to prove America is racist, all that does is make you double down more, because I'm trying to tell you part of your identity is racist. And that's a different conflict. So I want to focus on those values. I want to tap into a bigger story that says, I'm not trying to tell you that you have to think of yourself as racist. I'm trying to say like, this is, we're throwing around these ideas in order to polarize people. What's the bigger story here? How can we have a shared path forward, even if we maybe have some disagreements on these other ends? And my, usually when that happens, there tends to be a coming around the data as well eventually. But slinging data at each other doesn't solve values conflicts.
Come on. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't. And that's why, that's a good lead in kind of as we're beginning to wrap up. Because we know this is a political year, and we know things are going to be, people are going to be slinging data, slinging all kinds of stuff all over the place to irritate, to agitate, to cause division, to cause this chaos. And we know our values that Be the Bridge and what we are hoping and looking to do with God, Jesus at the center of all of this. How do you in this political year, how do you find hope? How do you find peace? How do you keep yourself kind of centered? Even as we have to, you know, we do this work and this is our life, but what do you do? And, you know, what kind of things could you, you know, share with people just to encourage them to, you know, find, you know, how do they find peace? How do they find hope?
I think a few things. I think we are really used to being outraged. There's a lot to be outraged about. And we live in a world that is not what our brains and bodies were really made for, if that makes any sense. Like it used to be that the things that your brain and body and heart and mind had to process were the things happening in your immediate community, the conflicts, the sadness, the traumas, the excited things. That's really when we look at like neuroscience and biology and things, that's the level of engagement with the world we're really like biologically set up for. That is not the world we currently live in. We are taking in trauma from Ukraine and Russia. We're taking in trauma from Palestine and Israel. We are taking in politics and news and information. The floodgates are open. It is hard to maintain peace within yourself if you are trying to take on and feel and be a voice for or speak to all of that. It's not possible.
Come on.
So I would say a few things. Be careful how much you're like, be careful or curate what you're putting in.
I like that. That's good.
If you are following people on social media and you're following them, they're an outrage follow, I call it, or like a hate follow, or like don't do that to yourself. Don't do that to yourself. That's not peace. It's not helping you. I promise. No one's a better person for following people that drive them crazy. Curate what information you take in that way. Like when I'm scrolling, and I'm not saying don't take in information about the world or don't be on top of what's happening in current events. I'm saying don't intentionally follow things that raise your blood pressure. There's enough to raise your blood pressure without that. I would also say curate as well your news sources. Like especially if we're on our phones, figure out what notifications are actually. Do you really need a notification every time a new news story hits? Probably not. I personally have a couple news podcasts I listen to in the morning on weekdays, and I otherwise, unless I hear through the grapevine that something crazy is happening, otherwise don't do a ton of engagement with current events and news. The couple podcasts I listen to are enough that I feel like I have a good overview of what's happening. I know if something like I knew about this conversation, I knew that what we're talking about today had been said because it was covered in those, which also means making sure if you're only taking in a couple sources, that they are not sources that are only from one, especially from my white people, that aren't just white perspectives or what is deemed newsworthy by organizations and run by whiteness who are, you know, picking what makes the news real. So that has been helpful. That's part of, those are just practical things. So, right. Like there are spiritual components and practices as well that I would recommend engaging in, contemplative prayer, intentional silence. When it's not negative 10 degrees out like it is here now, get outside, get fresh air, reconnected with, like, let your feet touch actual earth, because it's too easy to be so wrapped up in this, like, constant here's today's news story and tomorrow's news story and this person said this and that person said that, and now you're arguing on Facebook with this uncle and this other person sent you something in messages. Did you see what this person said? Like, that is not peace. That is not peace. So putting the phone down and actually touching the grass, is highly recommended. Highly recommended.
Yeah, you become what you consume.
Yeah. 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 So don't be disconnected completely.
Right.
Curate your connection though. Your connection, because we're kind of told that, like, we have to, like, follow all of the people and engage in all of the arguments, and that's not sustainable. That is fueling ourselves with like anger or outrage, and those things are they're fire. They burn up quick. They're not sustainable energy sources. And this is a long haul. And if you try to get up and sprint every day, all day, you won't make. I mean, look at what happened, like, post 2020, like summer of 2020, the drop off, because those were people fueled by, their fuel was short lived. It was anger. It was outrage. It was because it was right in front of their face. That was their fuel. And when that's your fuel, you will burn out on it. So similar with engaging with politics or engaging in this work in lots of areas, find a fuel source that is not short acting.
That's good. That's so good. Now to my, so for my college students who are going to watch this, I hope you're taking notes. Elizabeth just gave you a beautiful list of basic recommendations. Like real talk, you guys, you have to like get away from it all. Like press pause. You don't have to, like, I love how you were talking just about, you know, knowing everything, you know, and turning off some of the notifications, you know, for those of you who are on social media doing things, like, put it aside, take care of yourself.
You don't need a little red dot on Instagram and Facebook all the time reminding you to open it. You probably remind yourself, you probably open it automatically too much anyway. I know I do. So I took my notifications off for those, for all of my social media apps and things. Like, we don't need our, that constant hit to our brain of needing to pull it up. Like, we don't.
No. No. Oh, this has been so good. Elizabeth, we're going to have to do a part two or something else. I know we're going to do some
more. We know something will be said or something.
But I think the college students would love to hear from you again at some point. And I just want to say thank you for your time today. And for those of you that are going to watch this, listen, share this with your friends. Share this with your mama and your daddy and your cousins and them. This is a great opportunity for them to just hear a different perspective and just really tune in to a source that's giving non-biased information that's really going to help you grow, really help you to develop, really help you to be educated in a way that you can navigate the some of the craziness that's being said in our nation today. All right?
Absolutely. All right.
Take care.